What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today, we have another Q&A episode, so thank you to everybody who asked a question. And typically, I put up a Q&A box on Instagram, and I don't specify that it's for the podcast. And I do that because I get way more questions that way. And then I can do some of them for the podcast, and I can do the rest of them on Instagram. But I changed it up this week, and I said, hey, these are going to be specifically answered on the podcast. So obviously, I got a less question. We still have way too many questions, which is nice, and I'll answer the rest on Instagram like I always do, no problem. But it's nice to know that if you asked a question, you are a podcast listener, and you're going to be able to get that question answered on the podcast today. I hope, for the most part, we'll get through as many of these as we can, 30, 40 minutes, something like that. All right, less waffle, more questions. Here we go. First question, what's your goal for the marathon? When is it again? Will you share a bit about your training? I'm doing the Philly Marathon. When is it? I'm on my computer. I think it's, I should have the date in my mind. I think it's late October, Philly Marathon. It is, what date is it? Sheesh. I'm blind. It's not even on here. Sunday, November 23rd. So late November, nice kind of chilly weather. I'm sure it will be a great day to run. I'm quite excited. That's quite a far way away though. What is my goal? My goal is to break 4 hours. In order to do that, you kind of have to average about a 9-minute mile, a bit faster. I'm not currently fit enough to do that, but my goal is to be there by the time that comes. That to me, as of today, as of recording many months prior, feels like a nice goal. It is not something I'm absolutely 110% sure I can do. But it's something it's not so ambitious that, you know, I'm setting myself up for failure. I think it's a nice sweet spot of possible, you know, realistic and ambitious. So I'll share a bit more about my training as it gets closer. We're moving back up to New Jersey at the end of August. And so September, October, I'm like 10 weeks out at that point. I mean, the minute we touch down September, I mean, I'll be there end of August, but September 1st, I'll probably do a lot more marathon related content. I'll only be about 8 weeks out. So, all of September, all of October. No, I'll be about 11 weeks out. I'll be 11 weeks out. Okay. So a bit more time. Yeah. So I'll probably do a bit more marathon related content starting September when we're in the new house. And that'll be fun. For now, I'm running 3 days a week. Nothing too crazy. I do two kind of interval days and one longer run, and it's not rocket science. Next question. I'm struggling to stop tracking. I've been doing it a long time, but want to try not tracking, but nervous. Tips. I have a whole podcast on this. I'll link it in the description or the show notes or whatever. Basically, I think it's called How to Stop Tracking and Start Eating Mindfully. And I don't want to give away that whole podcast, but obviously you asked, so I'll answer a bit here. Not everybody will be different. So there's no one size fits all. I will generalize here, and I'll tell you why I'm generalizing, is this question often comes to me from somebody who's been tracking for a long time, who has a fairly regimented lifestyle, eats similarly on the day-to-day, you know, is a person not making it up on the fly, they're comfortable using a food scale, they have an idea of their portion sizes, they're just really nervous about not being absolutely sure. So I'm going to give you, let's say, two pieces of advice, and then I'll direct you to that podcast for the rest of it. The two pieces of advice I would give you, number one is, when you feel like it, keep using a food scale. People get really like, oh, food scale's disordered and tracking's disordered. It's like, first of all, no. But a lot of people, they forget that just because you're not opening the app doesn't mean you can't still use the food scale to portion things out for yourself. Like, whether I'm tracking or not, I know that I make my oatmeal with 100 grams of oats, let's say 16 grams of peanut butter, and then a yogurt drink or something like that, and I make a nice overnight oats or something. Lately, I've been making this overnight kind of chia pudding with a yogurt drink and 30 grams of chia seeds. Even if I'm not tracking, I still know those are good portions for me. And you probably have ideas about meals that you eat consistently and what the portions are like. You know that you want, you know, I'm making this up, by the way, but 5 ounces of chicken. You can still use a food scale. You know that you usually eat 200 grams of rice. You can use a food scale. You want 300, you know that 300 grams of sweet potato is roughly a ballpark portion for you. You can still use a food scale. You're topping olive oil on a salad. You can still use a food scale. Like, Again, you get to decide how you feel about that. But I think that the ability to use the food scale actually is a nice bridge between the idea. Like, people think that the kind of utopia of living is never, ever, 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 ever having to do anything but eyeball your food. You just eyeball everything. Everything is, this looks good enough. I don't know that that's how you need to think. I don't know that people need to think of that as where they need to get to with their relationship with food. There's nothing wrong with weighing out your oatmeal because you know that, like, you're like, I just want one serving of ice cream. There's nothing wrong with weighing it out. There's nothing wrong with it. So I think a lot of people forget that just because you're not tracking doesn't mean you can't still use a food scale and apply what you know. I promise you, using the food scale but not tracking is still a net increase in kind of relaxation and stress. Or decrease in stress, increase in relaxation, meaning you'll still feel the effect of not opening the app. It'll still feel nice. You putting something on food scale, again, everyone's different, but my suspicion is that you will not get that sort of triggering feeling by just putting something on a food scale if you're not also putting it in the app. So give that a shot. The second thing is I'll give three things. The second thing is I want you to think about it this way. Just want you to keep doing what you've been doing. I know that sounds obvious, but you probably are a person who can articulate to me what you're eating for breakfast and maybe what you're eating for lunch and what kind of snacks you like and how you build a dinner meal and what sort of after dinner snack you have if those are that's the eating pattern you have. Keep doing that. Keep eating those foods. It's like, oh, just because you're not putting in the app, between the fact that you already know what you do and how you eat, and, you know, you have my permission. I know it's a funny way of saying it, is if you need my permission, but I'm just, you know, maybe bringing this point to light that you can still use a food scale. Just keep doing what you're doing, right? You have a good idea of how you've been eating. Keep doing that. Keep your habits the same. If you were to send me pictures of your meals, they should look just like the meals you were making when you were tracking, right? So just keep doing what you're doing. And the third thing is maybe experiment with starting slow, right? Maybe next week you just don't track on Wednesday and you hear me say, hey, you can still use a food scale. I still want you to do what you normally do. Just don't put it in the app. Practice that once a week and then maybe two or three times a week. And then maybe only track one or two days a week. And then maybe have a week where you don't track. So if you're if that makes you feel more comfortable, this idea of going nice and slow, I think that can work incredibly well. Next question. I know it's important to train 0 to 2 RIR for muscle growth, but if you train further from that, will you still grow muscle just slower as an intermediate, not beginner to the gym? So it's more important to understand principles. The closer to failure you get on a set, the more stimulus you get. The closer to failure you go, the more stimulus you get per set. And so if you train further from that, maybe 3 RIR or 4 RIR or 5 RIR, can you still make progress? You can. But you'll need more sets because each of them will be less stimulative. So I don't know how many sets you're doing. If you're training with relatively low volume, I'd say my program is moderate to low volume, but that's because we train with high intensity. We train everything 0 to 2 RIR. So if you took my program and you trained everything at 4 or 5 RIR, I don't think you'll grow much muscle as a non-beginner. If you doubled my program volume, but you trained at 4 or 5 RIR, you could make progress because each of those sets would be, you know, again, it's not perfect math, but let's say they'd be roughly half as stimulative, for example. So it depends how many sets you're doing. I'd say if you're doing sets above 4 or 5 RIR, I'd say unless you're brand new to the gym, there's almost no amount of practical sets you could do to make progress. I'd say the 3 to 4 RIR is as high as I'd go, and you'll probably have to do a few more sets. Next question. I've regressed. I've lost about 2 to 3 reps on some lifts, but progressed on others over the course of a couple of months. Could this be a sign of under-recovering or just normal? It could be a few things. The first thing that jumps to my mind is maybe you lost some weight. Certain exercises will be more affected by loss in body weight, by you being literally a smaller person. Things like pressing movements tend to get hit the most. So in a fat loss phase, I would suspect most non-beginners see either a plateauing or a slight regression in some pressing strength. So that might be something you've experienced. I'd be curious the time span on these things. Oh, you said on the course of a couple of months. It could be a sign of those of not doing enough volume for those lifts. It also, ironically, could be a sign of overdoing those muscle groups. So you could be recovering systemically, but under recovering locally. And so maybe you're doing too much for that muscle, and that muscle locally is overtrained, but systemically you're doing just fine. And so other muscle groups at appropriate volumes are progressing just fine. It could also be that you're not doing enough on those exercises or those muscle groups, and for that reason, you're seeing some slight regressions because you were coming from a period of doing higher volumes, but now you're doing a little bit lower volume and not keeping up with previous strength progression. I also think that part of me wants to see your technique on some lifts. Sometimes people push themselves so hard on a lift and their technique slips a little bit, and by fixing their technique a little bit, they get weaker, but they're not giving themselves credit for having done so. And so they're like, oh, I'm two reps weaker. It's like, yeah, but you're going slower and lower on your RDLs, for example, right? Or it's like, oh, you lost 2 to 3 reps on, you know, a bicep curl, but all of a sudden, you know, you haven't been swinging the weight as much. And so it might be the case that I would want to look at a form video of when you were doing 2 to 3 reps more and a form video now and see if they are, in fact, apples to apples. I find that is often what happens, where you look at your numbers, but you forget that at that time, I do this all the time with one-on-one clients. I'll look at their progression sheets and I'll see that maybe they haven't progressed on a lift. And then we talk about it and say, yeah, but my, you know, at that week you told me, hey, I need to go slower and lower. And so I did that. And yeah, I lost a couple reps because my technique improved. So movement quality can go up and you can lose reps, but that's a good thing for as far as a stimulus at the muscle. Next question, volume equated. Is it better to split sets into 2 workouts versus just do all sets in 1? Like 4 sets of 8 chest press versus 2 sets of 8 twice a week. Thinking you'll be less fatigued so you can train harder. Yeah, so you're going to see better results doing 2 times 8 reps. So let's just use sets. Let's not worry about reps. If you take the same amount of volume and you split it over 2 workouts, or you do it all in 1 workout, you're going to see better results in 2 workouts. That is, we see that in the literature all the time. You know, we have studies where people do 1 set on Monday and 1 set on Thursday and they grow muscle. We have studies that show people do 3 to 4 sets on Monday and that's it, and they don't grow muscle. So where 2 sets done, 1 set on Monday, 1 set on Thursday, grew muscle, 4 sets done on Monday did not grow muscle. And so that just shows us the power of frequency. And that's why I think a program that doesn't hit each muscle group twice per week just is missing an opportunity to see better results for basically no downside. I'm not saying that you can't grow muscle training muscles once per week. You can, but I don't see why you wouldn't organize training to hit each muscle group twice. Organizing training that way doesn't cost you anything, right? It's like, should you study 8 hours on Monday or 4 hours on Monday and 4 hours on Thursday? And it's like, well, and I said, okay, why are you studying 8 hours on Monday? Can you not study on Thursday? You're like, no, I can study on Thursday too. I'm like, well, then just break it up. It's going to be better. So unless there's like some weird, I actually can't, because the bad part about that analogy that does not carry over is that most of the time people are also going to the gym on Thursday. So it's not like they don't have time for that second session. It's that they are just splitting it up like chest on Monday and back on Tuesday and legs on Thursday, instead of doing something like an upper lower split or a full body split where you can, you know, see higher frequencies per muscle group per week. Next question. My lower back is sometimes sore after doing RDLs. Not in a bad way sore. More I can feel I worked those muscles, but not my glutes or hamstrings. Does that mean I should work on strengthening my lower back more? Have had form checked and it's good. Maybe. My take is this, that, and I'm not saying that you're saying what I'm about to say. I'm not saying that you are saying that you are assuming your glutes and hams are getting no stimulus. So I think if your technique is good and you're training hard with your RDLs, your glutes and hams are getting, particularly your glutes, if you have quite a bit of knee bend, are getting a really good stimulus, whether or not they are the thing that's getting the most sore. I think your assumption that, hey, does that mean my lower back is the limiter? That means my lower back is getting the primary stimulus and that's why it's getting the most sore and it needs to get stronger. I don't think that's a terrible hypothesis. But I also think that this, if your form is actually good, then this will happen on its own. If your lower back is in fact a limiter, then it is in fact getting the best stimulus, and it will in fact get stronger, and this should even out a little bit over time. So I wouldn't hear you say this and think, oh, you got to do more lower back strengthening. I would say just keep doing what you're doing, and as long as you're progressing, your glutes and hams are the primary movers of this exercise. So the muscles that are actually performing hip extension, what a hinge is are the glutes and the hamstrings. And if your numbers are going up over time and your technique is good, I would put my faith in that rather than putting my faith in the soreness to tell me what's happening. Now, soreness is not irrelevant, and I think you're asking a good question. I'd be curious where you're at in 6 months of continuing to do this with good technique. Did your lower back catch up just by continuing to work hard? And in 6 months, are you, 20, 30 pounds up on your RDL? If you are with good technique, I'd feel confident your glutes and hams are getting the stimulus they need. Next question. How does one determine ideal body weight range for health? BMI, labs, aesthetic. Ideal body weight range is tricky. It's going to be very individual for sure. I think if I had to rank order the things that I would consider, number one would be labs. Number two would be waist to hip ratio. Waist to hip ratio is a decent proxy for abdominal fat, which is a decent proxy for visceral fat. And even if your blood work looks fine, but you have a waist to hip ratio that doesn't look great, and I don't have the reference ranges on hand, but you can Google them, the waist to hip ratio ranges. If you're like, hey, my blood work looks good, my cholesterol is good, ApoB is good, HbA1c is good, fasting glucose, insulin, good, inflammatory, CRP looks good, liver enzymes look good. If all that looks good, but your waist to hip ratio scores in a range that puts you, as per that single marker at risk, let's say, then you might be in a situation where you are healthy now, but maybe an increase in abdominal fat hasn't yet manifested itself in your blood work. And maybe you are not at risk yet, or you're at risk now, but things haven't manifested in a way that's going to change your blood work. Now, I certainly would not determine ideal weight range for health based on aesthetics. And I wouldn't use BMI on an individual level either. On a population level, as a screening tool, BMI's a good tool for what it does. But on an individual level, I wouldn't use it. On an individual level, I would use your labs. I would use your waist to hip ratio. And I would also probably want to pick some sort of performance metrics. You didn't ask necessarily like body weight. But if we're just talking about like things that I would look at for health, I would look at waist to hip ratio, I would look at my blood work, and I might pick, a mile time or a deadlift goal or some sort of performance metric that represents, the kind of exercise that I know is going to help me, right? If you want to have a sub 8 minute mile time, or I'm making that up, by the way, don't hold me. These are all like fairly arbitrary metrics. I hate when people are like, a man over 30 should be able to do these 10 things. Like, fuck off. But if you want to set a goal for yourself, something like maybe a sub 8 minute mile, something like a 1.5 times body weight. I'm making those things up. I think those are decent though. They will represent you doing exercise that's good for you, right? So the kind of exercise you would do to make sure you can run a sub 8 minute mile is going to be good for you. It's not necessarily the ability to run a sub 8 minute mile, but the training that you'd be doing to maintain or get to the point where you can do that. Same thing for the deadlift. Next question. Is there a way to quiet food noise without a GLP-1? My hunger is so loud and so constant, it's like an annoying mosquito buzzing around. I eat at maintenance. A weight is stable, tends to fluctuate up and down, but I'm a lean person who wouldn't really qualify for meds. So there's a lot of answers to this question, but I'm going to go down a route that I hope is a helpful listen to people, and it's something that I've said maybe here and there on the podcast, but you might be trying to maintain a physique where you'll never feel amazing. It's just too lean for you to feel amazing. Now, I want to be clear. I don't know much about you. You said I am a lean person, so I'm going to speak to that to some degree. And I think I was here a couple things here. Just because you're at maintenance calories does not mean you will feel amazing. Does not mean you won't be hungry. Just because you are giving your body the calories that it needs to maintain its weight is not sufficient for feeling good. You know how we know that? You can take a pro bodybuilder who's getting on stage and they're incredibly lean. They might be at energy balance, right? But they don't feel good. They're super duper hungry, right? At some point, you go outside of your, let's say, body fat set point range, and even being at energy balance, you won't feel very good. I have been in my life 220 and I've been 175 in my adult life. At 175, I'm 190-ish for context. That's 15 pounds below where I'm at right now. At 175, I've maintained that weight for several months at maintenance calories. And no amount of maintaining that weight will I ever feel good. It's too lean. My hunger, my genetic programmed hunger signaling is higher than that. Let's say at 175, my maintenance calorie is like 2,700. I made that up, but let's pretend like that's what it is. 2,700 calories will not turn my food noise off, even if I'm at energy balance. So you might be trying to maintain a physique that is just leaner than your genetic hunger signaling. And, you know, I want everyone to be in control of everything. I don't ever like being sort of like defeatist about this, about being like, oh, you know, just nothing you can do. But I would explore this and say, well, what if I weighed 3 to 5 pounds more, but I got to eat 200 more calories? Does that match up? Does that amount of calories do anything to my food noise? And I don't want to be sitting there being like, it's going to fix everything. But I just have seen that so many times where clients will try and, you know, they'll diet down to a certain level of leanness. They'll love the way they look, but it won't ever quite feel right at that many calories. And a couple pounds up, you know, 3 to 5 pounds up with a couple hundred extra calories, all of a sudden things click and they're like, oh, this is a much more sustainable way of living because I feel much better. So I hate that my answer is going to be, hey, add 100 or 200 calories. Do it for 6 months, see what happens. Do it for 3 months, see what happens. Outside of that, I mean, you know, making sure that you're eating satiating food with the calories that you are giving yourself, making sure that you're also enjoying that food. Sometimes food noise just has to do with the fact that you're yearning for something enjoyable and you're not, you know, do you have actual physiological hunger or do you have hedonic hunger of like, I miss enjoying something, right? Sometimes the most satiating option isn't the most satisfying option. And you might opt for something that's a little bit less satiating per calorie, but that you enjoy more. And the net balance of those two things in that context might be a better option. So I think that those can all be things to look at. I think also trying to identify when your food noise is loudest. Are there triggers? Are there environments? Are there people, scenarios where you feel like it's the toughest? Are you putting yourself in a lot of really challenging situations in terms of the people that you're around, the circumstances that you're in? You're in a lot of, you know, environments where other people are doing things that maybe you don't want to do. Those are all things that we can look at. Next question. What do you think about amino acids versus protein powder? Thinking of switching to Perfect Amitos instead of a plant-based protein powder I'm currently using. That would be a horrible, terrible, awful mistake. Amino acids are almost entirely trash. Protein powder is going to be better. The reason you're probably doing this is because it doesn't have any calories, but in every study that we do where we pit these two things against each other, protein powder is much better. So do not do this. If you are going to take a scoop of something, mix it in water, and hope that it helps you build muscle, it should be protein powder. Next question. Tips for balancing month-long vacation and health and fitness. No access to gym, long car rides, and eating out for most meals. I don't want to lose progress. Tip number one, get comfortable with losing some progress. You will lose some progress. I don't know if you'll gain weight. I mean, there's the nutrition side and the training side of this. There's a, whether it's cardio fitness you're talking about or muscle building fitness. I think, listen, if you said a 1 week vacation, I would have given you the traditional, hey, don't worry about it. It's just a week. The fact that you're talking about a month long vacation, I will concede that I too would consider this, especially if it's something that happens relatively frequently. What I will say is, if this is a once in a lifetime trip, right? You're going to you're driving up the western coast of South America. You're hitting, you know, whatever. You're doing something, just you're Euro tripping through Europe, whatever. I would give you that same speech about don't fucking worry about it. It's a once in a lifetime vacation. You know, you're going to lose a tiny bit of muscle. You're going to gain it back. No problem. Enjoy yourself, eat out, enjoy the culture. No problem. But you know, if this isn't a vacation that falls into that bucket and you don't feel that way about it, you know, I don't know. So there's things like, hey, bring a TRX band, you know, pack a couple of dumbbells. You know, let's put together, you know, bring a pull-up bar, bring some bands. You can hear it in my voice where I'm kind of like, is that worth it? The one I could see being worth it is the dumbbells, because I think actually the stimulus you could get, if someone's like, I brought bands with my vacation, it's like, well, I'm not saying bands are I don't want to poo-poo bands, and I don't want to poo-poo moving your body. All I'm saying is, you know, the difference in who you are 3 months after this vacation, if in one scenario you brought bands with you, and in another scenario you did nothing, but when you got back from your vacation, you got back into a consistent lifting routine, you will be the same person. I think dumbbells are just provide a greater stimulus that I think might actually be meaningful. If you could bring some actual load heavy enough to really challenge yourself with lunges and RDLs or presses and rows and, you know, curls and all that stuff. You could throw in push-ups, etc. Then I think, you know, now you have the opportunity to give yourself a robust enough stimulus where it's worth discussing. But if none of that seems like it's in the cards, then listen, it's a month-long vacation. I hope it's something fun. You know, enjoy taking a break from all this. You're going to be the same person in 6 months, right? You're going to resensitize to the training stimulus, and six months from now, whether you didn't take this month off or you did, you will be indistinguishable. So if you can bring dumbbells, then I think, hey, you can bring a TRX strap. I think that allows you to at least do some more challenging body weight stuff. You know, I've written workouts for clients that are like not bringing a single piece of equipment, and they want to do like, you know, burpees or elevated hand push-ups and long walking lunges and stuff. And frankly, nobody ever does them. And I don't blame them. You know, they look at that and they're like, I don't want to do this on vacation. This workout blows. And so if you have dumbbells, you can at least make it fun enough and stimulative enough where I think maybe it's worth it. If you have a TRX strap and some bands, I think you can get something done. But my heart is really in the immersing yourself in this vacation, enjoying yourself, and knowing that you will lose a tiny bit of gains, but you will gain fun and enjoyment and experience, hopefully of a lifetime, a very unique trip. And so hope some of that was helpful. And if you ever want to reach out to me personally and tell me what you got and go through a workout, I'm happy to do that. Next question. I have a coach, but I'm wondering if I can subscribe to your program for the community and form check aspects. Would love to be in, but need a bit more support. You can absolutely do that. Sign up for my program. That's how you get access to the community. If you don't want to use the program, no problem. I'll level with you. If you want to send some form videos, if you're paying for the group, it's probably bad business for me to say this, but like if you threw in your like RDL technique, or as long as you're not doing something like, yeah, even if you were doing something so blatantly out of our program, I want to help. If you're paying me the $34 a month and you want to send the occasional form video, go nuts. I'm happy to help you. And to be honest with you, I think the community is so fucking awesome. I love our community. It's so much fun. I think it's the right amount of chat. You know, it's not like an all-day chat feed, but we have plenty of chats per day. People ask really good questions. There's just like a lot of good camaraderie. I put quizzes in there. There's a whole bunch of exclusive training lectures. We do polls. It's a lot of fun in there. So if you sign up for the group, you'll get access to the community. If you don't want to use the program, no problem. If you want to send the occasional form video, and I say the occasional form video, I don't know why I phrase it that way. If you want to send form videos, like everyone else, for now, you know, I think that's fine. Yeah, I think that's absolutely fine. I'd love to have you. Next question. Do you ever use your leg sled to work glutes? I don't, but I absolutely program it for clients, and I absolutely think you can do it. You would put your feet pretty darn high on the platform. Sometimes I've even, depending on the length, how tall you are, you'd have your toes up off the edge of the leg sled. I tend to really, really like Bulgarian split squats and lunges, and I get an amazing glute stimulus with those. And so I find that I gravitate more towards using my leg sled for quads and for a mixed stance. So when I say mixed stance, I mean more of an adductor stance. So middle of the platform, feet maybe just outside shoulder width, toes maybe externally rotated 15 degrees, a lot of depth, knees outside the chest. I get a lot of good quad, a lot of glute, a lot of adductor in there kind of all together at once. So I don't personally use it for glutes, but I program it. Jenna, my wife, uses it for glutes. I think it can work great for glutes. It's just not something, maybe it's because I am tall enough where I'd have to have like half my foot off the top. But I also just, for me, something about Bulgarian split squats, I just get absolutely torched in my glutes. And so, again, that's just me. Some people, you know, don't feel every exercise the same as everyone else. And so, you know, try a bunch of things out, see what works for you. Next question. I work on my feet a lot all day, 12 to 14,000 steps. Do you have any running shoes you'd recommend for people who are very active? You know, I've talked a lot about running shoes with my coach, Alex Viata, and we, you know, for the most part, you need to just get shoes that are comfortable. The going into the running store and having the person there, like, check out your foot stride and it's mostly marketing. Especially because the minute you walk out there in a certain pair of shoes, your gait and how your foot strikes the floor and what pace you're running is all going to change just the foot to ground dynamics. And so what I would do is I would get a pair of shoes that you find comfortable and I would block out the noise. I'd go try some on the store. I'd say, hey, I'm going to go walk to the end of the store and back. And I'd find a pair of shoes that are comfortable. The one bug up my butt I'd have is if you have wide feet, get a wide shoe. I like Ultras. Ultras tend to have a little bit of a wider toe box. I also have wide feet. I think even if you don't have wide feet, I think sometimes shoes are so damn narrow. So at least give that a consideration. Go into the store and ask to try on something that's a little bit wider and see if you notice a difference. I don't think you need to go with a crazy amount of cushion. But if you are on your feet a ton, you might go with at least maybe a middle cushion, a moderate amount of cushion, not like a necessarily like a barefoot shoe or something like that. Next question. When does the next cycle of programming start? The next cycle of programming starts on June 16th. I'm recording this on June 5th. This might be out on Monday. So yeah, maybe a week from today, if you're listening to this on Monday, the 9th, is that even a real day? Does that day exist? Monday, the 9th. Yeah. Monday, the 9th. So this will be out Monday, the 9th. And it's the next program starts on June the 16th. So the following weekend, honestly, for the 33rd time in a row, I'm going to say that wholeheartedly from the depths of me, this is going to be the best cycle yet. It just keeps getting better and better. And that is because of your feedback, just the interactions I have with people in the group, the things that I'm learning, the things that we're trying, just very, very excited. Next question. I understand the concept of working out throughout the day, like doing a few sets at nap time, a few sets after lunch, a few sets while the kids are distracted. But how do you go throughout the day? Do you just be sweaty? Hello, Texas summer. Got you. And then, and what about warming up before your sets? Do you dive right back in or do you do a small jog in place to get your heart back? Really simple, really simple. Forget about needing a general dynamic warm-up. So what very commonly happens for me and Jenna is at 7:15, Emerson gets up at 7:30. So at like 7:15, we both are in the gym and we do like one or two exercises. No general warm-up. Just if she's doing leg extension, she does a light side of leg extension, a little bit heavier set of leg extension, and then she goes into her working sets. Maybe I'm doing wide grip pull down. I just do two warm-up sets of wide grip pull down, and then I do my working sets. You don't need to do a general warm-up. You can, by the way, if you like it and you have time for it, no problem. Specifically in this scenario, specifically new parents, people short on time, it's not something you need to do. I would do specific warm-up sets for the exercises that you're doing. And regardless of whether or not you're bopping in and bopping out, doing a few sets here, a few sets there, just think about warming up for the sets you're about to do. Now, I think physiologically from a gain, like from a muscle gain perspective, this works totally fine. The downside of doing it this way is if you feel like you struggle to get like mentally in the zone because you like do one exercise, then you have to go tend to your baby or do some other responsibility, and you have to come back and you have to kind of plug in mentally again. But that just is what it is. I feel like I struggle to do that. I like doing my workout in one, maybe max two stints. Sometimes it happens in three stints, but it just is what it is. Yeah, I'd rather do it in one go, but sometimes we get interrupted. So that kind of is what it is. Next question. What's your actual plan when reverse dieting clients one-on-one? So, yeah, you know, there was once a time where maybe it is still now, but my algorithm's not feeding it to me, where reverse dieting was just like this big hoopla of like boosting your metabolism and, you know, it's how you're going to cut on higher calories later and, you know, increase your metabolic rate and just kind of all this BS that doesn't actually exist, that none of what I just said happens, physiologically at least. And so, you know, then there was the other people who were like, you know, when you're done with a diet, you can just jump right back to maintenance. You don't need any reverse diet. There's no reason to go slow. Here's the deal. Physiologically, if you end your deficit and you're still losing weight, but you're done dieting, you're like, hey, I'm still in a deficit, but I'm done with this. Whatever size deficit you're still in, you can just eat that many more calories. Now, of course, your question should be, well, I don't know how much of a deficit I'm still in exactly. So how am I gonna magically add exactly that many calories? You don't know. And so physiologically speaking, there's no advantage to adding calories back slowly, period. However, practically, most people, when they end a deficit, are quite proud of the weight they've lost and they don't want to gain it back. And if I said, hey, you can go a little faster, and guess what? You'll feel better quicker. But the faster you go, the more risk you have in terms of overshooting. Or you could go a little slower. And, you know, of course you go slower, meaning you're adding calories back a bit slower. And so the length of time before you feel amazing again with a ton of food is longer. But you're less likely to overshoot. We're more likely to catch you before you or as you are overshooting, you know, before you've gained more weight, you know, as if you were going a bit faster. So when I reverse people, I have a chat with them. I say, how uncomfortable are you? How hungry are you? You know, if we went really slow, are you fiending for more food? If they are, we add back a bigger chunk. If somebody's like, nah, I'm just kind of over it. I lost, you know, most of the weight or all the weight I wanted to lose. I really don't want to gain it back. Like, you have two factors. How averse to weight regain are you? Some people are like, you know, I lost quite a bit of weight. You know, if I don't keep every single pound off, but I get to a really good place, I'll be happy. That's cool. And then the second thing is, how bad do you feel? So if you feel pretty good, when I say pretty good, I mean all things considered, and you definitely don't want to gain any weight back, or you want to give yourself every chance you can to maintain as much weight as possible, then I go slow. Now, there's no physiological advantage of going slow, but there's a practical advantage insofar as you're less likely to overshoot your calories that way. That's all. And so when it comes down to it, we typically will add somewhere between 1 and 300 calories per day immediately. From that point, we'll pay attention to the data. We'll see, you know, if we add in less calories, we might look every 1 to 2 weeks. If we add more calories, we might zoom out a little bit more and say, hey, let's see what happens every 2 to 4 weeks before we assess whether or not we want to add more. So even though I would say there's no physiological advantage to going slow, and I think that a lot of people talk a lot of smack and BS about reverse dieting, I think at the end of the day, if a client feels good enough to go slow, it gives them a better chance of keeping more weight off. And as long as it's not so slow that they are still feeling miserable, I think it can work fine. All right, guys. Thank you for asking questions. I'll see you in the next episode. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.